The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
First off, I want to say how grateful we should be that we have you at Relevant Radio along with Father Rocky and all the other people that are on the radio. You do so much for us.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Good afternoon. I'm Sheila Lagminas, filling in for Drew while he takes a few days off for vacation. He'll be back, and I'm thrilled to be here with a loaded lineup today of great guests. I'm really looking forward to talking with them. I was thinking before the show today how many of us, when the year turned, last year turned on New Year's Eve from 2020 over to 2021, didn't we celebrate that? I mean, every day we're alive, we should celebrate life, and many of us do, and we offer up prayers in the morning. Morning prayer. Thank you for this new day of life. We never are assured of the next hour, much less the next day. We should and are grateful for that, but we certainly hoped that 2021, everything would disappear, or we sort of had this illusion maybe, right, that 2020, how bad it was, would overnight kind of turn into, okay, new, fresh beginning. Let's get past all that. Let's go forward. Think about how many things happened to the good in 2020. How much in all the crises of 2020, we all learned, or many people learned, how to create good. The opportunities that lie in crises for new initiatives, new beginnings, people seeing a need and stepping up to fill it. And just heroic virtue, heroic actions. A lot of that happened. And maybe out of sight, people don't do that. They don't tend to do that to be honored in any way. They do it because the need is there. At least that's what we Christians should be doing. So a lot of things to talk about in all of that today. I've got a doctor on COVID coming up in the third hour today. And just a lot between the first hour right now, and I'm going to talk about those matters and what we need to be doing to reform ourselves as Christians in the world, just like the early church. That still is our mandate today. And then in between, many things going on we're covering. So your calls as well, and the number here as always, 888-914-9149. So looking over, you know, not just last year and this year, the differences between the world of today and the world, not just last year in 2020, but 500 years ago. There are, of course, vast differences, especially on a technological level. Oh my gosh, they couldn't have imagined what we can do today. But the differences in the culture may not be all that different. In fact, Archbishop Charles Chaput, the retired Archbishop of Philadelphia, recently noted those similarities. Political and social turmoil, big changes in technology that reshape how we think, learn, and work, and believe, and ambiguity and conflict within the church herself. It's pretty easy to see how all of that is true. The response of the church to all that, though, wasn't the best always. And we ended up, of course, with Martin Luther nailing up 90, going back and further in history, 95 theses on the church doors of Wittenberg Castle, and then he caused the split in the church that continues to this day. The issue for us today is, how are we going to respond to all that's going on? More fallen away, more unbelievers, more unaffiliated, and whether our response is going to be in line with what God would want. How do you know that? Prayer and discernment. Fran Mayer is here to help us walk through all of this. Senior, and I'm delighted to talk with Fran. He's senior fellow in Catholic Studies at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and a senior research associate at the University of Notre Dame. Fran is a former editor of the National Catholic Register, former chancellor for the Archdiocese of Denver under then Archbishop James Stafford and then under Archbishop Charles Chaput. He then served Archbishop Chaput as a special assistant in Philadelphia. Fran, it's been too long. I'm glad you're here today. Thanks for taking the time.
Oh, it's great to talk with you, Sheila. It's been too long, but I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
I as well, to have this conversation. There's so much you cover at Ethics and Public Policy Center, Fran, and you're writing, at least you're writing wherever your words are spoken, like at the recent Napa Institute, or wherever your articles have appeared, they are coalesced and combined at Ethics and Public Policy Center. So for anyone listening, eppc.org, look for Fran Mayer, and they're all there. We'll get to some of your most recent columns there, Fran, but the most recent one, is it in First Things, I think? That just came out?
Yes, it was. It's today in First Things, right?
Yes.
I think it's called "Looking Back to Think Forward."
Well, yeah, let's talk about that, because I was going over it before the show, and I really, I love, yeah, it is looking back to think forward. Of course, you're the one who wrote it, but I have it in front of me, that you say history is a great teacher. And then, friend, you turn around and say that history never really repeats itself, although we say that all the time, right? And, you know, don't learn from the mistakes of history and you're doomed to repeat them. History never really repeats itself, but you note wisely that human nature and the patterns of thought and behavior that mark it do repeat themselves and all the time. So looking back on crises of the past, in my setup I noted some, can help us think forward about the challenges of the present and future. We have so many, too many to count, Fran, crises of the present, and then we can assume if we don't resolve those, they're going to be crises of the future plus whatever else is coming. So on this feast of St. John Vianney, great patron of priests and of many other things, you are drawing from the wisdom of St. John Vianney about bad priests, worse people. Talk about that, and before complaining about priests, we Catholics might take a look at ourselves.
Yeah, I think one of the great thing about Vianney was that he had an earthiness about him that was just extraordinary. Mm-hmm. He underlined the fact that you know, priests have, I say this in the article, I mean, priests have both the privilege and the burden of pastoral authority. All of us as Christians, religious lay and priests, have a fundamental equality in baptism, and we're all equally co-responsible for the church. But, you know, somebody has to be the father of the family, and that's the pastor. If a priest is a good priest, a holy priest, he has good people. If he's a bad priest, he's got worse people. It's just the way it is. They make a model for the rest of us, you know, that power of that model is extremely important, either for good or not so good. And Vianney makes that point when he says bad priests, worse people. It's why poor behavior on the part of the clergy has such a potentially damaging effect on lay people. The point that I make, though, in the piece, Sheila, as I'm sure you're aware, is that blaming the clergy is a long-term habit of a lot of lay people, and it typically turns into an alibi for our own bad behavior, and that's never acceptable, because if we're co-responsible for the church, then we need to act like it, even when our leaders may not be doing their job.
People focus on that a lot, Fran. It's amazing. When they do great things or just noble and courageous things, we don't hear a lot about that. When there's even the whisper of wrongdoing, we hear it everywhere. And so that's just sort of a tendency of lay people. It's certainly a tendency of secular media. They're going to pick that up really fast and run with it.
Yeah, but well, I served in diocesan service for 27 years, and when I entered diocesan service after I left the National Catholic Registry, you know, I was very nervous that working inside the church was going to somehow alienate me or turn me into a cynic about priests and bishops. And honestly, it's done exactly the opposite. I mean, I met so many terrific men who were just decent guys doing the very best that they could in a heroic fashion, and that's really the model that I take with me into my retirement. I mean, these guys were just doing a great job the best way they could. And of course, you're always going to have bad apples. It's just the way it is anywhere. But the overwhelming majority of the men that I worked with were really admirable priests, and I'm very grateful to have had the opportunity to serve with them.
Well, and so you, Fran, of all people, especially on this feast day of St. John Vianney, patron of priests, can speak to that. And can speak to, yes, we have a significant drop in vocations over a lot of years. But, you know, we also have these days, and I don't know when it might have started to upturn. I have a keen sense of this, having a son who's a priest. But the young, and they call John Paul II generation, many of them, I don't know if they still do. But there are many great young priests doing just great things, very faithful sons of the church, doing wonderful things for the people, on fire with the faith, very devoted to pastoral ministry, but also also, Fran, to, as you know, intellectual scholarship, academics, academia. Why? Because they want to be good preachers also and deliver good homilies to teach the people through their homilies, as well as bring them closer to Christ. It's really all about pointing people to Christ and drawing them to Christ through each homily. So that's all out there. And it's, as you note in your article, that people will follow good priests anywhere, no matter what the cost. Most lay people love their priests, and rightly so. But you also know, but nothing alienates faithful lay people more reliably than clergy who violate the dignity of the vocation for which they're called. So again, on this Feast of St. John Vianney, but really, Fran, on any day, because the Catholic Church is, like, you know, all religions and churches are suffering right now. So do you see, especially during COVID, when churches were closed, shut, locked, no masses available except online for most people, we need a reset here. People talk about the Great Reset or the Great Reform. We need a reform. You've written about this in the church. What do we do about what you just said? Finding great priests, finding great liturgies, staying with where you are, unless, you know, it's just really bad. And then following that and taking that out at the end of each Mass into the world, as we're called to do.
Well, I think the first thing you have to do, Sheila, and I would really recommend this to everybody who's listening, you have to recover the memory of the church. You have to study history. I don't mean study it to get a degree or anything, but just wonderful reading about some of the saints like John Fisher and Thomas More. And Philip Hughes has a very readable history of the church that's a very important text, because if you don't know the history of the church, you really lose the identity. You lose the identity of being a Christian and a Catholic, and you also very easily can fall victim to pessimism and despair. I mean, we've been in a lot of trouble as a community, plenty of times, and the difficulties that we're going through now are serious ones, but it has been much worse at a number of times in history. And if you don't understand that, if you don't really have it as a living memory, you're going to be prone to despair, which is just not appropriate at all. You know, you were talking about young priests a couple of minutes ago, and it's quite true that in many places vocations are down. But I've got two very close friends, one Augustinian and another Philadelphia diocesan priest. They're both in their 30s, smart as whips, and really good, motivated guys. And I could tick off probably a dozen or two dozen of those guys that I know around the country. So the numbers may be down, but the people who are staying or the people who are really committed are just absolutely first-rate people. And we have to get used to the idea of dead weight being shed and focusing on the good in order to begin the process of rebuilding, which we've done again and again and again throughout history. So, I mean, one of the things that I talk about all the time is that realism is a good thing. The truth sets us free. So facing our problems and really understanding them and where they came from is very important. The trouble is that if you focus too much on that, you can lose energy, you can lose hope, and there's absolutely no excuse for that, because if you know history, you know that history is the teacher of two great virtues: humility, because we're always messing things up, and hope, because God always gives us the means to rebuild. I mean, we're a very inventive people, and we do know how to rebuild and create beauty, and those two virtues together are kind of a fruit of remembering the history of the church. So I don't know. I think I like everybody else, I swing back and forth between being really distressed and utterly confident. And that's just the nature. You know, C.S. Lewis talked about the wave theory of human life. I mean, we have crests and troughs, and so you're just always dealing with that, which is, I guess, why you have to have both a sense of history and a really good prayer life. One other point that I want to add, you were talking about COVID. I'll give you a perfect example of how powerful pastoral leadership is. We live in a very nice neighborhood north of Philadelphia, and we're in a beautiful parish and a beautiful community. When we moved here 10 years ago, the parish was dying. The pastor was older. he had really, he was a good man, but he had really run out of gas. He'd been in the job for more than 20 years in the parish, and I really worried that the parish was going to survive. We got a guy in his early 50s, a son in a family of seven, a fireball, and has completely turned the parish around. During COVID, our contributions on a weekly basis went up. I mean, people just were inspired to believe that the parish had had a real future. And he added a passion to his work and a beauty to the surroundings of the parish. It made all the difference in the world. One guy did that, one pastor. That's the power of pastoral leadership from a really good priest.
Mm. And that's what a lot of people have said about some of the things that are very creative. I just was talking to a young priest yesterday about that. Some of the very creative things that young priest, he knows because he's a young priest, we're doing in 2020. And we've read about some in Catholic media throughout the year, Fran, but it's really good for people to hear that. And I know some of you want to weigh in or ask Fran your own questions about these things, about history, about the year of COVID, and we're not really out. It wasn't a year. We're still in it. 888-914-9149. Fran, you make some really good points in here. I want to stick with history for a minute, because instead of saying, oh, we're going to do both, the both end of history and then where we are now and what we need to do right now, because it doesn't just seem like it is the truth that from the earliest church, the very first disciples, to now, it remains that we are challenged in the public square. We are threatened in the public square. We have cultural threats and challenges today that didn't exist in the past. However, they had some that don't exist now. And, I mean, people don't tend to be beheaded in America for being, you know, a follower of Christ. But there's all sorts of other challenges. And so we need to learn from this. And you, Fran, this is fascinating. You bring up, and you call it one awkward detail, about Savonarola, a Dominican preacher in the city of Florence. I was fascinated by this history because a lot of people have heard the name but don't know the history. And you tease it out and bring it to a really important point about what we can learn without taking people through the tall weeds of, I love history, but without taking people through that, how a pope, you know, declared him, what, a heretic, and yet that pope turned around to be not a good pope. And so it's fascinating that the cause for his canonization, his sainthood, still exists, and it's never been closed. Just what's the point of telling that story today, because it's an important one?
Well, Savonarola was one of the early... Savonarola worked toward the end of the 15th century, and if you look at the history of the church in the 15th century, it's a complete catastrophe. I mean, it began with three rival popes, each with their own faction. It was a century that was loaded with political conflict and bloody warfare, and it ended with the Renaissance papacy, which was one of the absolute low points of the papacy. There are times in history that it's been worse. I mean, like the 10th century had some terrible popes. But Alexander VI was the pope at the time of both John Colet that I write about and Savonarola. And Savonarola preached a very strong message of reform in the city of Florence. And he was a very, very powerful preacher. He got crosswise with Alexander VI, who was the pope at the time, both on a political level, because the papacy was a political reality in Italy at the time, but also in terms of Alexander's personal lifestyle. I mean, Alexander was, he was a nepotist. He was... he fathered a number of children illegitimately. He was a really wicked man. And Savonarola preached about that, which was politically unwise because that got him excommunicated and then eventually tried and executed for heresy. But it has never been, it's always been a disputed case as to whether Savonarola was a saint or a sinner, whether he was a political zealot or a genuine prophet. I think, I quote John Olin, the Fordham scholar in that in the piece that I did, and I think when you read his material and the scholarship on him, you tend to see him really as a good man who was mistreated by church authority and ultimately killed. And he set the stage in the late 15th century for the other Catholic reformers who followed him, like John Colet and Erasmus and John Fisher and Thomas More. So he's important in that regard. There's deep division even within the Dominican community about Savonarola. His case was opened as recently as, I don't know, a couple of decades ago. There was a cardinal who was pushing very hard for advancing his cause beyond its current state. He died, and it's sort of moribund right now, but it's never been withdrawn. And it's just really interesting. He's an extremely interesting personality. So that's one of the reasons that I wrote about him. He's a perfect example of how complicated human nature can be in these difficult historical circumstances.
In fact, you make that point very clearly. I want to come to this. It's just a couple of paragraphs down from that. And again, I'm Sheila Logminas in for Drew Mariani. He's taking a few days off on vacation. And I love being here and filling in. I'm talking with a friend, Fran Mayer, I haven't talked to in far too long. And we're talking about, actually, it's at eppc.org. All of his columns are. But this was a talk he gave at the recent Napa Institute. Excellent gathering of great minds and Catholic from all over the country who come to hear really important ideas, you know, fires the imagination and the faith. And I love Fran at the Knapp Institute and many other gatherings like that, the celebration of sacraments. But while we still have time, this goes back to your article on eppc.org on reforming the church. And you cite a Yale historian saying essentially this, that fragmentation of Christendom back in history was the most immediate and long-lasting effect of the Reformations. It splintered the church, made many churches out there. Worldviews were created by it, changed Western civilization radically. Eventually, other forces increased its strength and volume, and the desacralization of, you know, society itself just kept overflowing from that. Here we are today in the culture we live in. What's going on in the schools? What's going on in the universities? What's going on in politics? And you say what about the reform you write of so well at EPPC? Because we're down to very little time, and people need, what do we do?
Well, what do you do, first of all, is you actually reform yourself. And every great scholar of every period of reform says that. You're not going to get a reform of the church until you reform yourself. And you have some power over yourself in a way that you don't have over your institutions. The church always works from the basis of individual conversion, personal witness, personal repentance. And there's an ink spot effect on that. If enough people do that, little by little, it gradually changes the culture. What do you do? Well, I'd suggest reading Epistle to the Romans, because Paul wrote that epistle specifically to a church just like ours, in a culture just like ours, that was increasingly, or actually very anti-Christian, highly pagan. And how do you live in that kind of an environment without losing your identity?
Well, since I said we just have a few minutes, I should have clarified to the bottom of the hour. But I have Fran Mayer in, A New Reformation. How about that? Within the Catholic Church. That, more on that next.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Your daily dose of faith, hope, and charity. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Drew Mariani Show. I'm Sheila Logminas in for Drew while he takes some time off for vacation, talking with Fran Mayer. Fran Mayer is a good friend, longtime, outstanding speaker and writer of all things Catholic. He's got a lot of experience in, he's former editor of the National Catholic Register, senior fellow now in Catholic Studies at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and senior research associate at Notre Dame. And in between those two things, Catholic Register and what he's doing now at EPPC, And at Notre Dame, he's former chancellor for the Archdiocese of Denver under then Archbishop James Stafford, and then in Denver under Archbishop Charles Chaput, outstanding chancellor. And then he, in Philadelphia, went on to serve Archbishop Chaput as a special assistant in Philadelphia. So he knows the mind and scholarship of Archbishop Chaput well, and the books he's put out and the writing he's done. And Fran himself writes of many things. We're talking right now about a Reformation. And Fran, so it's not a counter-Reformation you're writing about, because in your Napa Institute talk you gave, today you have an article in First Things magazine. We're continuing to talk about that. But you also have in here, EPPC.org, your articles, A New Reformation, and the two are of a piece, because that's what you're really after, aren't you? Time and again in what you write, you point us back to ourselves, not in a way that Pope Francis calls being self-referential, but in a way that we need to look into ourselves, as Catholics should every day. How am I doing? At the end of the day, the examine, how did I do? How am I doing? Where am I in my conversion, right? That's where a Reformation begins.
Yeah, actually, you know, every Reformation is RE-formation. I mean, it's a rebuilding of one's Christian identity, and a rebuilding through your own conversion, a rebuilding of the constitution of the Church. And so, I mean, I like to think of it that way, Sheila, because there really wasn't just one Reformation. Carlos Ayer, the Yale historian, doesn't use that expression. He doesn't talk about the counter-Reformation or the Reformation. He talks about Reformations, plural, with an S on the end of it. Mm-hmm. That the Reformation period was really an opportunity for everyone to take a hard look at how sclerotic the Church had become. And the question was, okay, how do we revivify it? How do we get back to the sources of Christian life? And that led some people away from the Church and other people to have a deeper experience of what the Catholic faith meant. We do this all the time. There are huge historical periods where this rises to the top and you're really focused on the internal conflicts in the Church. But this struggle to be a purer Christian, to have a purer Christian community, to have worship that's pure and clean and beautiful, that goes on all the time, every generation. And we should just embrace that. You know, I mean, that's what we were talking earlier about, the temptation to distress, which is very normal. But we also have to remember that this is just part of the process of purifying ourselves and purifying the Church that goes on in every generation. So it's not something to be afraid of. It's something to embrace, even when it can sometimes be very difficult.
Well, and that gets back to, if anybody just tuned in at the bottom of the hour, what I brought up from your article, that this is where we find ourselves today. You take us through a piece of history in the Reformation, and Martin Luther and the theses and other things in history. And you say, and this is where we find ourselves today. So you ask the reader, what can we do about it? You asked those at the Napa Institute Conference, what can we do about it? And it's so helpful, Fran, that you've told them and you tell us. The gulf separating the 1500s from today is huge. And history, again, never repeats itself, but patterns of behavior and thought by people do. And so what you're saying is, the point of your comments is today's efforts to train better church leaders to manage church resources more effectively and to plan for the future church needs in an unfriendly world, increasingly unfriendly to the Church, are vitally important. And so that takes heroic courage. And yet we are in a culture where people are so kind of afraid and timid about speaking up, speaking out, it's not even taking a stance, Fran. It's clarity with charity. It's engaging and not shying away from, whether it's social media or just conversations they can be in their sphere of influence or their social circles or their parish, and, you know, making a very charitable, if you will, correction of what human nature is, what human flourishing means, what human happiness is, what the Church teaches. And if you do it as a witness, hey, this is what the Church and the sacraments have done for me, let me share that with you, all the better. Because that's your personal experience and witness you can't deny.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the other thing, too, as you were talking, I was listening to you, and, of course, we've been friends a long time. And I've listened to Drew for a very long time as well. I mean, the value of Drew's show and the value of the work that you've done over the years, Sheila, is twofold. Number one, it's catechetical. It lets people learn about the faith by what you say, what Drew says, and what the guests that you bring on say. But the other thing, too, is that what you're providing is a sense of community. That Christianity is basically a community of friends, and the community is built around friendship with Jesus Christ. But it's friends, just like every good marriage is finally a friendship, you know, and friendship includes being able to commiserate with each other, being able to listen to each other's mm-hmm. sufferings and hopes and joys and that sort of thing. And what you do is provide one means of people to come together, to learn, and to share in a way that reinforces community when the community is under, as you indicated, a great deal of pressure in some ways. So I think how that connects to the idea of reformation, I think people reform themselves when they listen to other friends who have had the same experiences and gone through them and come out a better person, and they also provide support to one another, and that is all part of the rebuilding of the Christian identity that goes on a regular basis. I love the idea of the Reformation, and I've said I'm kind of an addict for history anyway, ever since I was in grammar school, because it's memory. And I've used this image a number of times, but if I have amnesia, basically I've lost my personhood. I've become someone that my history can be invented by other people, and I can be redirected in a direction that I don't want to go. So memory is very important on a personal level. It's very important on a national and a church level as well. And that's why I'm always going back and kind of studying these crisis points in Christian history, because they're sources of learning about how you get into trouble, and they're also encouragement, because if they were fatal, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation right now. Mm-hmm. So God always manages to pull us out of our own problems if we're just willing to cooperate with him.
Yeah,
but
if
we don't know that, if we don't remember that, then very easily get lost.
Well, and that's the prayer and discernment. We have to ask for that. It's just, it's there. I mean, it's the simple saying, Fran. I've been using it this week for a number of occasions, and I thought, you know, it's so simple, and yet it's so true. God provides. So when we pray and ask for discernment, the grace of discernment and the grace, therefore, whatever you discern, to carry out God's will, if you are discerning that, that's all available. We just have to ask. There's so much we can do for the reformation. I love that as well, and that's why I love the articles you've written about it and the things you've spoken about it, again, most recently at Napa Institute, but other places, Fran Mayer. You are very good at that. If you just tune in, I'm Sheila Logminas in for Drew, talking with Fran Mayer, Ethics and Public Policy Center, fellow in Catholic Studies there, former chancellor and then a special assistant to Archbishop Chaput, and he writes so very well of all things Catholic and the church in the world today, facing both, bringing the lessons of history into where we are today and where we're going forward. The number is 888-914-9149. And Fran, I'm going to take a call from Charlie in Philadelphia. Charlie, go ahead.
Sure.
Thanks for calling.
The book, I believe it was essays by Pope Leo the 13th, and one of them was about Savonarola, and I never had heard of him. And he talks about that was the beginning of the bonfire of the vanities, where people in the town of Florence would come out and burn their romantic novels and their fancy clothes and all their little dainty things and all, because they were so inspired by him, they were repentant and would get rid of all their stuff like that. I thought that was pretty interesting, but that's where the term bonfire to vanities comes from, I believe.
Oh, Charlie, you're right.
Good
That's
point.
Exactly where it comes from. And, you know, they took that expression, I guess they made a very different film about it back in, I think, the 80s or the 90s. But that's exactly, I mean, basically what he did in Florence. Florence was a very wealthy and a powerful city-state at the time. And he had this tremendous charisma about him as a preacher, and really affected people profoundly to go through a period of penitence based on the words that he said.
That's a really good. It's really good, Charlie, that you knew that and that you bring that up, because that's a lesson for all of us right now. It's. I was reading, I think, in your piece, Fran, somewhere, and I'm not even going to try to pluck it out right now. But it connected something I talked with George Weigel about Monday. I think in his book, The New Pope. I'm not sure. I've been reading so much lately, but it's of a piece with the thinking that, and also, Fran, the recent St. Ignatius of Loyola feast day, it all goes together. I was talking to Father Spitzer about that Monday. But it all goes together in that when we go after, when Charlie brought up the frilly things, the luxurious things and so forth, when we go after those things, those are not ultimately fulfilling or satisfying. It's only when we go after eternal truths and after the pursuit of our walk with God, our closeness to God, our closeness to Christ, true prayer. That may sound so simple, right? But yet that remains so profoundly true since Christ came into this world.
It is simple. That's the point. I mean, we're talking about history and books and all this stuff, and not everybody has time to drill down into 16th century Catholicism. I mean, that sounds kind of crazy for most people because they're busy making a living. And I don't want to suggest that that's the way you get to be a holy person. You get to be a holy person by doing the really simple things that anybody can do. I mean, if you're reading Scripture on a regular basis, and not just reading it, but praying over it, it doesn't have to be more than 15 minutes a day, but that 15 minutes becomes the source of a new life. Same if you're going to an adoration chapel. Any simple thing that a person can do to wash away all the junk that you accumulate in modern bourgeois life is really important. You know, somebody told me this morning, I think it was, a friend said that we're born in the image of God and we spend much of the rest of our life accumulating things to obscure that image. And it really affected me because we live pretty well in this country. Even our poor people do. And I'm certainly not hurting, and I've had a good career and a comfortable life. And getting rid of some of that stuff, stripping it away and getting back down to the basics can be a very good and healthy experience, a kind of a renovating experience.
Renovating is what we need in ourselves, renew ourselves, to renew our faith, to be strengthened, to go out each day. I mean, this is Mother Teresa's nuns, for all the work they've done all over the world and wherever they set up another convent, another mission. They have one mission, and that's to start each day before the Eucharist, before the Blessed Sacrament, in communion, in prayer. And then they go out and do what many would consider to be almost superhuman or almost impossible for them to fathom, when you really are just picking people up off the streets in the worst conditions, cleaning them, showing them the human face, smiling human face.
Charlie mentioned the Bonfire of the Vanities, and another one that Savonarola gave a great, I think I mentioned it, a great 1495 sermon on the renovation of the church. And that word renovation, like the word reformation, is very useful, because what does renovate mean? It means to make new, and that's straight out of Revelation, right? Make all things new. And what Savonarola and every real reformer tries to do is not blow things up, but to take the good animating spirit in the church and in the Christian life and make it new again, make it fresh again. And anything that we do to encourage that in our own personal life and in the lives of the people that we affect, that's a reformation in its own way, on a small level, but a really powerful level, because that's where reform starts.
And yet, everybody looks outward, out there, it's sort of to blame other people for why things are so bad. You note that in your piece titled A New Reformation. You note well that the trouble is that what you refer to accurately as the grievance culture, the kind of culture we have today. You said that is deadly. There's always another oppressor to expose and accuse. Grievance feels good in an ugly sort of way, and it's addictive, you say. It presumes the wickedness of anyone who disagrees. Ooh, that's sharp, and yet that's true. It kills reasoned discourse. George Weigel talks about being in Poland for 3 weeks having intense conversation sessions with young people. Could you imagine? I mean, I know we can imagine that because we've both been in those kind of conversations. But I mean, where is that discourse gone here? And you say, after all, who wants to spend time wasting time listening to stupid or evil people, especially if by definition they're stupid or evil because their views conflict with our own?
I know.
You know, this is where it is. And this explains, you say, why our nation's political life is now so toxic. But it's not only our leaders who are at fault. It's that politics is our new religion. And the more our own people make it so, the more we're complicit in this.
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing, again, to take it back to the personal, I always thought that my primary sin was pride, you know, a disguised but really intense form of pride. I mentioned that to my wife once when we were getting ready to go to confession. She laughed in my face. She said, "Your problem is anger." And you know what? She's right. I like being angry. Because there's so much to be angry about, but
well,
can you imagine? That's a little taste of a little outpost of hell in your personality when you become so fixed on a particular sin that you like going to it. It's your go-to sin. And
right.
I don't know if I've reformed that part of me, but I sure am much more conscious of it. People today are angry all the time. They like to be angry, and it motivates them. And that just produces what you just described. I mean, it produces a completely toxic culture because if you don't get control of that in yourself, you can hardly expect anybody else to have control of it in their own lives.
Well, that's where it begins, getting a control of it in yourself. Fran Mayer, more of this conversation next.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show, Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
Drew Mariani is on your radio now, coast to coast on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Drew Mariani Show. Drew's not here. He's on vacation, taking a few days off. I'm Sheila Logmina's. Happy to be in. Happy to have great guests like my guest right now. I'm having a compelling conversation with Fran Mayer. Fran Mayer is Senior Fellow in Catholic Studies at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and a Senior Research Associate at the University of Notre Dame. He mingles with some great folks there. I love Dr. Carter Sneed and the gang there. Wonderful studies they do there, wonderful conferences they put on. Fran is a former editor of the National Catholic Register, former chancellor for the Archdiocese of Denver under both former Archbishop James Stafford and then under Archbishop Charles Chaput when he was Denver Archbishop. And then Fran served Archbishop Chaput as a special assistant in Philadelphia, all that experience. And now he's doing wonderful work at Ethics and Public Policy Center and giving talks at things like the Napa Institute, which was just held very recently. We were going over the talk he gave there. And Fran, I want to go back to something you were saying earlier. Phones are open, 888-914-9149. If you have any questions about what Fran has and I have been, because I sign on to what he's saying, we have a need for a new reformation. Learn from history, but start right now going forward. What are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about the culture right now? As Pope Francis calls it, the throwaway culture. We're throwing people away who we don't agree with, and much less other people who are vulnerable. But Fran has really called us out that we Americans have always had a split personality when it comes to the past. On the one hand, the founders were shaped by biblical morality and Enlightenment thought. They had deep admiration for the Roman Republic in the classical age. These things shaped the checks and balances of the structure of our government. But our problem with the past lies in the fact that an entirely new order of the ages has come about these days. How our mind has changed and ideas turn into actions, and what ideas are filling our minds now, especially by social media and technology and news media and so on, turns into the action, mob actions, mob mentalities. Well, we're taking your calls as well, and Fran will answer your questions, or we'll do our best. 888-914-9149. Fran, I want to go back to what you said a little bit ago, though. I bookmarked that in my mind when you brought up, when I said, you know, in your parish, in your sphere of influence, in yourself, whatever we can do to learn something and then speak it or relive it or witness to it. And you brought up friendships, the importance of friendship. When George Weigel was on with me Monday, I brought up how Cardinal Francis George, former Archbishop of Chicago, in one of his books spelled out what a lot of us who knew him well knew to be his philosophy of friendship. There's a whole philosophy to that. And it's classical. It goes back to the classical age, much less through human behavior now. Talk about that for a moment, Fran, the importance of friendship now.
Well, because, now, particularly when the church is under pressure and there's so many challenges to belief, you really do need friends in order to feel like you're not alone. I mean, we're social animals. We in this country, we place an immense amount of attention on the individual. It's kind of misleading because a lot of the choices that were given by our culture are really very narrow in their content, highly materialistic. But we're emotional animals that need emotional support, and friendship is a sharing of ideas, it's a sharing of emotions, and we draw sustenance from other people, and we give it just by our presence and our approval. So, as I indicated earlier in the show, I mean, when you look at a marriage, all marriages is a particularly intense and fertile friendship. My wife and I have been married for, you know, almost 51 years, and I don't have a better friend. Friendships, you know, Aristotle all of the great thinkers in history have emphasized the importance of friendship to have a genuinely human life. It's particularly important in Christianity because Jesus himself called his disciples his friends, not his servants. And so if you want to sustain your faith, it's theoretically possible to do it alone, but to deepen it and grow it, you really do need to be able to have conversations about Jesus and the Bible and your beliefs with people who reinforce and correct your ideas by virtue of the love that they bear for you in a friendship. It's very, very important.
And that's, I think, why Cardinal George pointed it out so well in his first book, of the two I'm thinking of, because that's just the importance of friendship. And look at how much more important that became, Fran, in 2020, certainly, the year of lockdown, shut-ins, and so forth. So many people lonely, so many people depressed from that, not having that social. See that? Look at that. Not having social interaction. There's a lot to the human touch, to the human face. We've been looking at, this is not against masks at all, I'm just saying, we've been looking at masked faces. I remember the cover of The Economist when it showed the globe with a big mask over it, and had the sign hanging on it, closed. The world was closed with a mask on it. I remember that and thought, wow, that in one picture, that captures where we are. And so that's when it became necessary to find ways to reach out to people however we could. And so now we're able to more, but always in a safe-minded way, because we have a pernicious, nasty variant out there of COVID. And yet, right now, in all times, we've had plagues in history, and your whole devotion to history here is teaching us what we can learn from it. So I'm glad you're able to bring that up. And so, Fran, with what time we have, you note that Benedictine scholar Jean Leclerc, and again, this is learning from what people have taught us, once said there can be no reform of the church, and people want the church to reform, right? But they don't want the second part of that, without reforming the Christian. And so reform of the institution depends on reform of the individual, and that depends, as you said, Fran Mayer, on reforming men and women who themselves are reformed by their love for Christ, remade in the fabric of their souls, their very souls. You pointed out your friendship with your wife, Sue Ann, who's just, you are a marvelous couple. When I see you two on Facebook, I just think, what a witness to marriage. What a witness to friendship in marriage. And you two just exude joy and the true love that one has for another in every way. Friendship, going through life together, the ups and downs, sharing with Sue Ann your own addiction to anger, maybe. That made me think, wrapping this into a question, that made me think of Father Spitzer. When Father Spitzer was on with me Monday, A caller called in. We got a lot of calls. A caller called in and asked him something about, Father, we go to confession, and we tend to confess, some of us, the same sins over and over and over again. When are we finally going to get over confessing that same sin all the time? And I had to laugh to myself and think, yeah, how true is that? So, you know, when maybe we go in and confess, I don't know, the sin of anger or the sin of gossip, those maybe who gossip, then you find yourself doing it again and again and again. If nothing else, maybe humiliation.
Yeah, I mean, so many people, I'm not the only one with this problem. I mean, you go from anger to pride to fear to anger to pride to fear. It's just like a big triangle of the same sins again and again and again. And that's just part of human life. And the value of confession is that that's kind of a gradual redirection of your life in the right way. That that's why one of the reasons why confession is so important is that it's an enabler of this reformation that we're talking about in terms of our personal life, Sheila. Just to get back to for half a second to the friendship thing, if you look at one of the effects of COVID, like for example on our son who has Down syndrome, when he was forced to be out of work, it had a tremendous isolating effect on him that he didn't have the capacity to overcome. I mean, I'm married, I have a wife, we're living together and that, but he had friends that he couldn't be in touch with on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And that had a really negative and distressing effect on his life. And that I'm sure you could multiply that millions of times around the country. Friendship is kind of the river of life, and it is so very important to have the right friends, which is why having good Christian friends is so important, and to reinforce those friends and allow them to do the same for you. I'm sorry to redirect things like that, but I just reminded me of my own experience with our son.
That's perfect, and I'm glad you brought your son into it. I love to see your travel photos with you and Sue Ann and your son. He looks so happy, just like you and Sue Ann do. So what a great witness right there. People need to see that joy of marriage and families. Families witnessing to the joy and the connection to each other is going to help change our culture. And as you say at the end of your article, Fran, what the church finally needs now and tomorrow and always is saints. And you just named some of the ways we can do that. Fran Mayer, time flies, as always. It's been such a pleasure to have you, and thank you.